Okay, Shane, proceed.
Good evening. Shane Creech, Director of Public Works. We're here to talk about some proposed changes we have to the ordinance associated with parking and the parking utility. Mike Sokoff, who's the parking and transit manager, is with me tonight, so I'm gonna let him, drive.
Great. Thank you all for allowing us to be here this evening. We have about 12 slides that we'll go through. The first one has to do with operational flexibility. So in the city ordinances, the current ordinances, 14.4.13 through 14.4.17, are very specific. They denote exactly where meter times and zones are located in the downtown footprint. And as you can imagine, this makes it somewhat difficult for the parking utility to adapt zones and meter times to the changing needs of a vibrant downtown area. Currently, we have 6 meter zones in the downtown area ranging from 10 hours to 24 minutes. As an example, in front of the former CenturyLink building, those meters now are 24-minute meters. So we plan to propose reducing the number of zones to 4. We would have a 10-hour, a 3-hour, a 1-hour, and a 15-minute curbside meter space zone.
Mike, can I interrupt you there just to clarify right here? When you say we plan to propose, you're not proposing that here. Are you talking about bringing something to a regular council meeting that would be a proposal to this end?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. We also plan to adjust the locations of the zones to meet the changing needs of the area. We will request that council allow the Public Works Director to make operational decisions regarding meter times and zones based on the need as those needs change. And we will ask council to amend the language and the referenced ordinances accordingly. The parking utility has engaged Walker Consultants to complete a multi-phase project to assist us with research and recommendations regarding modernizing the existing parking utility. And a cornerstone of modernization requires better operational flexibility. So 5 of the cities that have been researched by Walker handle parking in a similar way to what we plan to propose, those being St. Louis, Kansas City, Springfield, Wichita, Kansas, and Champaign, Illinois. Operational flexibility indeed is the first step in a multi-step process to adjust parking services to better meet the needs of the community. Future phases of the project will include a comprehensive study of current operations that will include rate comparisons, both meter and parking structures, parking garage utilization, future infrastructure needs, that being traditional single space parking meters, centralized kiosks, and the currently we have the Park mobile app and want to make sure that that stays relevant. And then the concept of dynamic meters or dynamic metering possibilities, which essentially is being able to adjust the rates depending on the need in any particular area at any particular time. This is the proposed parking meter zone changes that we would like to make. You'll notice there are a series of colors. We'll have 1-hour meters, like across from the post office. Right now, those are 24-minute meters. We would like to propose extending those to 1 hour. The majority of the meter changes will be 3-hour meters, where they are currently 2 hours. That will allow people to have more time to spend in the downtown area shopping, eating, and moving around without having to worry about going back to the meters every 2 hours. And then we will have our 10-hour meters, which we currently have in the perimeter of campus or at the perimeter of the downtown area, the CID boundary, for primarily individuals who work downtown and need extended parking times. We will actually increase the number of those meters than that we have now. And then we have some residential and special use areas up in the northeast quadrant of the boundary. The North Art District meeting or parking permitted spaces and so on for the residential areas in the northeast part of the quadrant. And then, of course, those yellow dots represent the 15-minute meters that we will propose to come drop-off and pick-up spaces that are currently now bagged with red bags.
All the ones that you have here that are yellow dots are now bagged?
Yes.
Okay. So you're not talking about changing which ones those are. You're just talking about changing the
Actually, we'll be reducing the number that are current had based on CID recommendation.
Okay.
So, speaking of that, Mr. Foster, the CID curbside space program has been in effect since 2020. We currently have 32 spaces in the downtown area that have been designed or designated as curbside pickup spaces that are designed to assist businesses during the COVID era. The meters are covered with red meter bags currently. So in meeting with the CID, along with city management, we believe that it's no longer necessary to have bag meters serving as curbside spaces. What we would like to do with CID's cooperation is to propose the spaces be reduced to 18 and the meters be set at a 15-minute time limit. So they will become paid meters instead of free parking in those areas. The CID will provide signage at the meters to designate them as short-term metered parking. Another thing that has been brought to our attention that we would like to propose to the council is that in the alignment of the meter and garage operation times, in 2014, based on a request from the CID, City Council approved amending Monday to Saturday on-street parking from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. to 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Current garage hours of operation remain at 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. So trying to align that so that both on-street meters and garage parking are the same as far as operation hours. So based on a request from the CID and a recommendation from the Parking Advisory Commission, staff will be requesting, we are requesting to revert Monday to Saturday on-street metered parking back to 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And this will align operation times and ultimately reduce confusion for citizens utilizing downtown parking. The reason we are going this particular way is that adjusting the meters is less complicated than making adjustments to the gate arm system, which would require third-party assistance. And the parking staff can adjust the on-street meter times without any assistance from a third party. The next thing that we will be proposing to council is the Annie Fisher Pantry parking. So in October of 2021, the parking utility was contacted by an administrator at the Annie Fisher Food Pantry at 616 Park Avenue related to parking tickets issued to community members visiting the pantry. Those community members often did not have money to pay the meters while using the pantry. So parking staff received permission from the city manager to place hoods on the 7 meters along the 200 block of North 7th nearest the pantry for use only by those using the pantry, which we have and has been in place for a little over 2 years now. So we will be proposing a continued partnership with the Annie Fisher Pantry by removing the actual meter heads and replacing them with signage indicating the spaces are for pantry use only on Monday and Wednesday. Enforcement will be on a complaint only basis, and the anticipated revenue loss will be around a total of $181.28 per year for those 7 meters. Designated taxi parking. I've listed the current city ordinance as it relates to taxi stands, and essentially, this particular slide shows you where those designated taxi parking stands are located. But as we know, with the increased popularity of rideshare programs like Uber and Lyft, it's become necessary to add rideshare parking to the current designated locations so that rideshare vehicles do not congest traffic waiting for customers by parking in the street. At times, the parking utility has received concerns from the Columbia Police Department regarding this issue. So what we would like to do is simply add the words rideshare to the existing ordinance so that they may park there. Como park cards. For several years, the city's made reloadable cards available to the public that can be preloaded with funds and used to pay for parking at a meter or a parking structure. Currently, various city departments use these cards for staff who need metered parking as a part of their job responsibilities. In our analysis, the cards account for about 6% of meter revenue. And we've learned that the blank cards that we purchase in bulk will now cost the city approximately $5 each, and that there's a shortage of these cards due to the reader technology and the meters themselves becoming obsolete. So it's also becoming more and more difficult to repair the meters, because when the readers start to go bad, we have difficulty finding the parts from the company. And we would like to phase out the selling of any new cards beginning May 1st of 2024. And so unless there are major concerns, we anticipate having the ordinance changes on the council agenda for the first for a first reading as soon as December 18th. And if so, the public hearing would take place at the January 16th City Council meeting. Entertain any questions.
I've got a question. Roy.
Could you speak a little bit more to the dynamic metering? Understanding, like, what's the highest that the meters will go? Could you speak a little bit more to that?
We don't really know a rate right now, Mr. Lovelady. It's just the concept of being able to adjust the rates depending on the demand for certain areas of town at certain times during the year. That would be the rates would actually be set by council. That still fall into your purview. It's just the concept of being able to make those changes as we believe that it's necessary.
So it wouldn't necessarily be dynamic in the sense that Friday would cost one thing, on Saturday it would cost another, or you're just talking about dynamic that over time it could be adjusted with council approval.
And essentially, what we struggle with in Columbia is balance. We will have some areas on the eastern part of Broadway, as an example, that stay full all the time, while the western part of Broadway has very adequate parking along the on-street. We need to balance that so that all parkers have the opportunity to use whatever meters are available, both on the east and west side of Broadway. That's dynamic parking meter, so that we can adjust that balance as necessary to make sure that there is adequate turnover and people can actually find parking.
We've got a consultant looking at what other places do and making recommendations. So the only thing, the stuff we've talked about here tonight are the things we're gonna change with the ordinance, just to provide us the flexibility to change where we have a 10-hour meter versus a 1-hour meter. As far as rates, all that stuff, we're going to get recommendations and we'll have to come back to you. Like, nothing in what we're changing in the ordinance will change the current rates of parking. That's kind of phase two of this whole thing. So as far as dynamic parking is concerned, the idea of maybe you pay a little bit less the further you are away from the epicenter of downtown versus if you're parked really, you know, really close to something. We don't have any of those abilities currently, but that's just some of the stuff that we're looking at. So that's kind of that next phase. Really, we just want some operational flexibility to adapt how long you're allowed to park at certain meters based on what's outside. Kind of like the 15-minute meters were tied to picking up, a lot of times it's picking up food. I've got no ability to change that without going back to council. Well, as no one's parking it outside the CenturyLink building and going in to pay their telephone bill anymore. And so I can't make any of those changes, only by a block by block. And so I want some flexibility to make those changes with help from the CID. Yeah. If we ever did anything wrong, it would always come back to you all.
Yeah, and if you talk to the CID or the DLC, then they both will tell you that there's concern with parking right now in downtown. Sure. With the meter bags, what you'll have is people, because there's a bag meter, you have somebody who will park there, and they'll park there all day because there's no charge. And they're supposed to move around. It says you're supposed to move, but that doesn't always happen. And so having some type of ability to track that will help us. The dynamic meters is one thing that you've seen in a lot of communities, especially with the Park Mobile app, which I know some people really don't like. However, it does allow for you to have some of that ability to kind of phase out the barriers, or even if there's an event in town, where you say, okay, because there's going to be an event and there's going to be a lot of parking, we want to make sure that people are moving, that this allows us to be able to do that.
Roy, you want to follow up?
Yeah, he kind of touched on one thing with events. Would the price be changing based off events?
It could.
Mm-hmm. And he also kind of addressed it going down, but how would you speak to it going up? Like, so this area isn't used as much, so we'll lower it over here, but this area is used a lot. So are we going to potentially raise it?
That's the idea.
I believe that you could. That's something we have to
vet
out.
That's part of that second phase where we actually do that study, where we can actually bring back something that says, okay, this is what would make sense. So for instance, like from the downtown, from the core downtown Broadway, they want to say, because Broadway, we may want to have a higher cost to park here, but as you go further down Walnut or further down toward the campus, you may want to lower that price to kind of make sure people are parking that way, as opposed to everybody trying to park right here in the center of town.
I understand. I just make sure we're looking at it equitably.
Yes, sir.
Sure. Absolutely. Sure.
Other questions? I was on the radio this morning and got a couple of calls about the cards. Both callers concerned about those being phased out. It sounds like they're not financially viable anymore operationally. Is that right?
Partly financial, partly just the ability, the technical side, to be able to actually use them. As the meters fail, we can't replace the cards.
So some of the meters, yeah. I have to say I'm one of those who would hate to see them go. I'd love to use the cards when I had one. For people who have the cards, would they be able to be reimbursed for any?
Well, they would be able to be reloaded until the card itself fails, or we are absolutely unable to use them. We would not stop using them. We just would sell new cards.
My concern is, as I have meters that you can no longer use it, I can't. You might pull into a parking spot and want to use your park card, and that meter, well, it won't work. So right. Somehow I have to get out in front of that and let folks know that, you know, keep using it, but it might not be as reliable as time goes on because I can't.
Technology is physically a lot, so we kind of got to move the times.
Are we talking about still being able to use coins, or are we going to be moving to an app only kind of thing, or a payment at a kiosk? No, we don't really know that yet, do we?
I think that we will probably always have some coin usage because that's just too popular.
Yeah.
Even if we go to a multi-space type metering system, they would still have to accept coinage.
And I have one other question. The ride share, is that from what it says, you've already added some spaces just for ride share? Is that right? No. You're looking at adding ride share to
just
the taxi stands.
Yes. Yeah. Just the ability for those ride share companies to use the same space that the taxis use.
Right now, when it gets congested downtown, when the bars let out or what have you, they're right in amongst where all the folks are. They're trying to pick up their person. We want to get them where the taxis are.
My husband drives for Uber and Lyft and has gotten the because of the very explicit taxi stand piece of the ordinance and that they cannot go there, and then they get ticketed by the police.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds, as Mr. Waterman took us a while ago, but I'm again wondering about process from here, whether there's going to be feedback when this comes back to council. We have the opportunity to ask other questions, or you really want us to just hit you with any questions we have now?
No, we're going to have a public hearing on this.
Yeah.
In order to change the ordinance, I've got to have a public hearing.
Public hearing or an old business item?
I guess it'd be an old business item.
Okay. It's not a public hearing.
But there would be public comment.
Public comment.
About it at that time. And you would take that into consideration about any changes that you do make and so forth. But really, this is more an exploration of you being able to have more flexibility and to explore other possibilities. Is that right at this point? But my guess is that when you come to some decisions about what you would like to do, that would come back to council at that point.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course, the consultants have just started the process, so we will wait for their recommendations and have serious conversations.
Do you have a time frame for that?
I'd say probably within the next couple of months, they should have a pretty good handle.
But at the next meeting this month, we're talking about
just changing the ability to
providing flexibility at that point. Okay.
Part of that was we've been working with the district for like the past year on all those things you mentioned, on several of those things, trying to get ready for that. Then it became apparent we needed to talk about kind of the future of the parking utility and needed to get some recommendations for that. But I didn't want to hold up the ability to get the 15-minute meters, remove the meters at the food pantry, those kind of things I want to go ahead and move forward on, because there'll be a lot of discussion about those things. Almost all of those things we're talking about in that phase two will take an additional ordinance change to change any rates or vary the rates, those kind of things. All that stuff's going to come back to you to be discussed. This was just kind of to allow us to do some of the stuff we've been talking about over the past year while we work towards other recommendations.
Any other questions from council at this point? Comments? Do you have what you need from us tonight?
So,
yeah.
Carl?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Carlin, who's making the next presentation? All right.
Yes. All right. Good evening, council, Mayor Pro Tem. Tonight, you're going to get a presentation on the natural resources inventory. And this report, you'll learn more about shortly, and the associated data really provides useful information on changes in land cover that then allows for data-driven planning, analysis, and evaluation of city and community decisions. With us tonight, from the staff side, GIS supervisor, John Townsend, community conservationist, Danielle Fox will be here to answer any city side questions. And then I'll turn it over now to Jessica Norris, who's representing Biohabitats, who's the consulting contractor on the development of the natural resources inventory.
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here. So Biohabitats was actually joined on this contract by Davey Resource Group, which is the same tree people who worked on the Urban Forest Master Plan, which is one of the reasons we wanted to work with them. So Davey and Biohabitats began this, I think we were working on contracts starting last summer, and we've been busy since then. What I want to do, I think, is on the next slide, I've only got about 10 slides just to familiarize you a little bit with the data set and the report and what's available online. This is not, and something to take action on. It's really just a new tool that the city's going to have access to. So I'll start with my A's migrated. I'll start with just a little bit of an introduction and review the purpose and study area, and then mention the ecological context of the city and how the framework sort of put together, and talk a little bit about the data that's reflected in the report. And move on to some commentary about the next steps. So let's go ahead into the purpose slide. Natural resource inventories in general have some of the purposes that Eric was just mentioning. So to see how the landscape has changed since the last NRI was one of the big ones for us on this project. Prioritizing natural areas, there's different ways to rank them
or rank different areas of the city, and then think about how land use choices are affecting them. That's sort of the general purpose of any NRI that you know, gets done, or natural resource inventory. But this one in particular allows us to take advantage of some technological advancements that have come along since the 2000 version, which you have, which you know, the city's been using, and then also to compare it to future states. So the technology that we use now is going to be very easier and cheaper, and it's going to be very easily compared backwards in time. So mostly what we're going to be focusing on, or mostly what we focused on, is the changes in land use. So the natural resource inventory, that kind of project, you talk about a lot of very broad things about the soils and the climate and things like that. Those things, you know, a lot of them have not changed much, and they're not changing very fast, and they haven't changed very much since 2007. But what's changed a lot is where the houses are and where the forest is and where there's trees planted and where there's different kinds of vegetation and what your streams are doing, et cetera. So that was the real focus of this piece of work. And I would say that also this is, like, we want to be talking about it and thinking about it in the context of, you know, future planning and comprehensive planning. It's kind of a brain prompt to start thinking about all the questions that you can ask of this powerful data set, and all the ways in which this tool can be used. So on the next slide, the study area. So the last time this was done, which was a little bit more painstaking manual classification of high-resolution aerial imagery into different land cover classes of forest and grasslands and farmlands and you know, buildings, etc. The last time this classification was done was in 2007, and it was a slightly different study area, so you can see like the overlap's a little different. This year, the last time the city did this, it was really focused on that CATSO planning area. And this year we kind of hand moved it around a little bit so we could capture some more land down here in the southeast where we're interested in thinking about what's going on around the airport and some development pressures. And we took out some areas around the northwest that have not changed very much. So compared to last time, perfect overlap. So when you take home this study and you're looking at it tonight, you'll notice that you can't completely compare the entire study area from before to the entire study area now because they don't perfectly overlap. You're just overlapping. You're just looking at the parts that do overlap. The entire study area for 2022 data was 230 square miles. 68 of those are in the city. And of course, we've had significant population growth between over the last 15 years from 2007 to 2022. So this next section is really more, this is one of those examples of things that probably, you know, has not changed very much since 2007. These are things we know about our city and about our area in terms of the ecological context. Columbia sits at the intersection of two really distinct ecoregions or ecological regions, where in the northeast you have what was historically prairie. It was much more open, it's flatter. That is the ecoregion of the clay pan prairie. And then bisecting the study area really is the border with the river hills, and that's a much steeper, different sorts of soils. That's where you've had a lot more trees, a lot more forest, and especially in steeper and areas. So the ecoregion, this is a section of the report that gives you a little bit of background. It goes a little light because what we were, again, focusing on is the change. So we can move on to that, kind of getting there. The other basic, you know, sort of characterization of the ecological context of the area is to think in terms of our watersheds. It's important to think about watersheds. Like, we spend all of our time concentrating on the, you know, the borders of the city or the borders of the study area. The water doesn't care. So a lot of these watersheds extend well beyond the edges of the city. And so they're integrating, you know, ecological processes and landscape use and land use decisions from outside of our area and into Randolph County, et cetera, going up in the different watersheds. But those watersheds are just areas where all of the water kind of drains to a single point. Most of them in our part of the world, or within the study area, are kind of draining mostly towards the southwest, towards the Missouri, with the notable exception of over there on the east, Cedar Creek comes straight down to a different input that's a little bit outside the study area. All right. So that's the first section of the report that is online. And then you'll get into thinking more about the actual comparison of the data from 2022 to 2015. Everybody with me? So in terms of land cover change, we can look at the classification of this high resolution aerial photography as it was in 2015 and as it is today. There's a couple of important things that have changed about the way we're doing the data. One of them is that we wanted to introduce a shrub class because we had a bunch of areas that were really not forested, but they were showing up as forest or they were showing up as grass, and it wasn't accurate because we do have some shrub areas, especially on old farm fields. So we wanted to introduce that as a distinct class. So that meant that some of the things that were grasslands became shrublands, and some of the things that were forests became shrublands in the new data set. It's a little bit different. But overall, some of the more interesting, you know, pieces is that the tree canopy has declined by 7% for a total of 33% tree canopy cover in the city. That tends to be what catches people's attention. Shrubs, as I said, you can't really compare it to before because we didn't have a shrub class. You'll see that there's a lot of movement on those grass and croplands, and partly that's because it's actually really, it's tough for humans or computers or AI or machine learning to distinguish between grasses and croplands all year round. So there's some of those are shifting because we think they were misclassified in 2007. But mostly you're seeing a swap there between some of the grasslands and some of the agricultural areas. You do legitimately see a bunch less bare ground in the imagery that's taken in 2022. And that's because there was actually, you know, a lot more development happening right then in 2007. So bare ground actually declined. Open water stayed the same. All right, so, and then we can also use this to look at examine the cities or the study area really, according to different ecological groupings. So in the next slide, we'll talk about watersheds. So remember, or keep in mind that, you know, one of the most important things about watersheds is how much parking lot and surface and impervious surfaces you have within that watershed, which tells you a lot about how fast and how hot and how dirty the water is that's going to be hitting your streams within that watershed. But remember that some of these watersheds extend way beyond the city. So when you see something on this report that says that this percentage of the watershed is in is impervious surface, it may be that the entire watershed is not here. Anyway, so we can use this to get some useful metrics to compare among sensible ecological groups like watersheds. And probably the thing that we spent the most time in was on canopy loss and thinking about the tree cover change. So on the next slide, we've got some an overall summary of loss of tree cover, loss of trees and canopy, according to the wards in the city. So there was most of them, or all of, in within each grouping, you'd have some gain and some loss. So you'd have a net loss or a net gain. Is there a question? So this was like a really fun part of the data set, right? So we got to see where trees were coming in, where they were winking out, and where there was no change. Most of it's no change. But if you think about where you lost trees since 2007, it can tell you some things about how your planning is working. So on the next, what we did is in the middle of this, after we had all this classification, we had this data set to play with, we went and interviewed, and your staff was facilitating a whole bunch of different conversations with the stormwater folks and with transportation and planning to think about, like, we're kind of trying to get them to know about this data set and think about what kinds of questions they might want to ask. And they generated some. We didn't take it all through everything that this data set has to offer, but we did a few sort of key questions, mostly focused around this tree canopy loss, which is given into more detail in the report. So on the next slide, there's an example of thinking about tree canopy loss in different kinds of ecological habitats, or ecological values. So this is a data set, this purple stuff is the Southeastern Conservation Blueprint. And it tells you where there is land that is particularly important for birds and wildlife and species of plants. So along the Missouri River, you're going to have a very rich ecological, it's going to be very rich ecologically because the riverways serve as like a superhighway for animals and plants to migrate up and down. So they're very important for landscape scale connectivity.
And then you can see the major, the big purple stripes sort of across the city are also really, they're more important because of landscape connectivity, and they're usually along your waterways within the city. But so then this data set lets us ask the question, once we've, you know, we're looking at the Southeastern Conservation Blueprint in this area, we have some areas that are, you know, high habitat value and some areas that, you know, there's not much going on there ecologically. How much tree canopy were we losing in which parts? And I think this is like something to be proud of for the city of Columbia, that in the areas of the highest, you know, priorities for ecological functions, you lost very little canopy. You lost 34 acres of canopy in total, compared to most of your canopy loss was happening in places that were low priority. So that suggests that you're doing a job of protecting some of that higher priority areas. We already discussed, like, it's focused around floodplain. There's a lot of, you know, regulatory things that are helping you along and protecting your forest and those floodplains. But that's still an interesting thing to know that it's working pretty well. There's something quite comparable. We did one of the things that came out of the staff discussions was to think about how much canopy loss has happened along your streams, along Columbia's streams. And so we looked at various buffer widths and how much canopy had been lost, and we separated those out by areas that were platted after 2007 and before 2007. And that was interesting because you could see when that stormwater ordinance kicked in 2007 and newly platted land had to protect their stream buffers, you lost very little canopy right around your stream, so it was well protected. This data set could probably help you zero in on some areas that could use some reforestation to protect water quality. And I think my last technical slide is still on canopy loss, still thinking about where your trees are and where you lost them, but this time looking not at habitat value, but at social vulnerability. So there's this federal data set of the Social Vulnerability Index, which is going to compile 32, so a lot of different variables with income, transportation, languages spoken, and provide an index of how vulnerable to change or vulnerable to disruption a city tract would be, a census tract, actually.
I ask a question right here? Yeah. I don't know if we have the whole slide on the screen. Are we missing low vulnerable there? Is there another category?
Least somewhat vulnerable most.
Most. So, we can't see that.
The dark purple is going to be most vulnerable.
Okay.
So that's those census tracts down and east of 63. That means that there's lower incomes, lower education attainment. It's a large suite of different variables. It's a federal data set.
Yeah.
So what we were really doing was saying within those socially vulnerable areas, you know, what were your trees doing? And you can see that there's not a really clear pattern, but you can look at that kind of question and start to think, where did we lose trees? In this case, we lost most trees in the least vulnerable areas. It's probably ag fields where there's not a lot of, you know, indicators of social vulnerability happening. That's probably where most of the tree loss was. There's a fair amount of tree loss in some of the most vulnerable areas, probably rural, lower income areas. So my last slide is sort of a nod towards the final section of the report, which again is on the website. I think we're going to jump over to the website. We're actually early, is that?
It's okay.
A little ahead of ourselves. Pat on the back, I'm almost through too. Depending on how long we want to do. The last section, we tried to think about the questions that we come up with the staff and talking to all, you know, different departments, and trying to think about the ways that natural resources function and how they can be protected over larger landscapes. And we pulled together a short list of some of the precedent policies and protections that are in place to support ecological systems and ecological functions in other municipalities. So the final section just reviews some of this, the principles of how to protect and regulate natural resources. And there's really big themes of how you do that and what you need to pay attention to. You got to be paying attention to your biodiversity and special features. So your pink planarian down there in the, out in the city, but you know, you've got some regional endemics and special species nearby. Again, that habitat connectivity, like where species can move across either seeds or critters. Thinking about threats, which is often invasive species, invasive plants.
plants. There's, you know, suites of overbrowse by deer. A focus on water resources also for a bunch of reasons, because they're a focus of biodiversity. They, a lot of species use them at different times of their life cycle. And then other thoughts or sort of considerations to support the overall ecological resilience. So I'd like to just jump over, if we could, to the website where there is, are we on the links?
Yeah.
So there's a short little, you know, summary of everything, and there's, I guess there's not the slides I just showed you, but all of those images are coming directly out of the top link, which is the second link, which is the full report. It's only about 30, 40 pages. We tried to keep it short and, you know, pithy. But the fun part is the interactive map. So if you would, please, Mr. Hempel, you can actually dive into this data and go swimming around in your neighbor's backyard and see what kind of land use and land covers and change that is coming up there. There's a bunch of different data sets here. These little eyeballs, you've got to click on them to make it pop up. And you probably need to zoom in to the land cover classes to appear. And this is a little bit, it's a little tricky because, you know, when you're using a computer to classify all these pieces of land, and, you know, you do have, there are, you know, very small details around the edges. And it's not meant to be perfect. It's meant to integrate a lot of information over a broad scale. And we've got hundreds of square miles that we're thinking about. So it's important to remember that the value of these tools in part is so that you can have them now and then compare them into the future with similar methodologies and similar classifications. And, you know, not so much that every single pixel of a, you know, square foot is going to be exactly accurate. And I think that's all that we were going to try to sum up. It's been a great pleasure to work with your staff here at Sustainability and IT. I always say that.
Well, we're not surprised, actually. Thank you, Jessica. Questions from council at this point? I have a few. Eric, one of the big questions for me is, what do we do with this data? And, you know, especially when you're talking about loss of canopy and that kind of thing, and like Roy is noticing the third ward in particular being most vulnerable. It'd be interesting to see an overlay of canopy loss, you know, over those areas too, to see what the impact is. So there's an equity question here too, in terms of those who are vulnerable and what we're doing there. What do we do with this information? Canopy loss being one of those examples.
Yeah. So I think what this really does is it helps us guide program design. Looking forward, it helps us guide program design. Whether that's with the Show Me the Heat project, you know, we looked at the environmental conditions where it's hotter, and then also with this layer of data, it helps us see what the land cover conditions are. So maybe where increased canopy, where canopy loss might have exacerbated the situation in an area as far as the temperature, and then I think also. And target projects, whether that's tree planting or other interventions, so that we can make better informed decisions at a neighborhood level, and then also at a broader landscape level. If that's connecting parks or enhancing other features. The other piece that I'm glad to see and the potential to analyze is to look at social vulnerability index or other federal indices that are coming out now. They're particularly attached to funding with the federal government's Justice 40 initiative. There's a lot of real emphasis and support for investment and projects that will invest in underrepresented neighborhoods, which we see. You know, we can start to really overlay all of these data points and make sure that our improvements are focused in those ways.
And I would guess that in a city like ours that's growing the way it is, development that takes place, that protection is a big part of this too, protecting habitats, but protecting the canopy as much as possible and so forth, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, so the example I gave was more from a human resilience perspective, and that's probably just because that's where more of my understanding is, but certainly looking at connectedness of natural areas, protecting the good things we have, and amplifying their ability to serve as refuges for species, or you know, increasing the effectiveness of maybe some of our native pollinator corridors, and really connecting significant areas that we can identify using this data. And then I think it's also worth noting that we can look and see to some degree potentially how past policies have put us in a better place, or maybe where we could refine some policy making. There's that potential there. We haven't really explored that yet, but we've had some informal conversations with the planning department. I remember early on in this process of imagining ways that we can use the output, and now we've got the output to inform a review of policies or something like that.
Okay. Anything else occur to the council member? All right. Thank you, Jessica, Eric, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll stand adjourned at 6:36. Well, unless somebody has something else they want to talk about. Anybody have anything else? We're adjourned. See you at 7 o'clock.